ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th Canto, Chapter 1, The History of the Life of Ajamil. So it's text 58, 60. how many verses are on the board? Yes. I can't turn around and look. I did something to my shoulder. I need Chaitanya's help. Yeah, I definitely need Lord Chaitanya's help.
Ekadasavanangyata Kutri Sandesha Kridriya Vijaha Adaya Tatra Avritta Palapushpa Samit Kushan
Ekadasavanangyata
Putri Sandesha Kridvijaha Adaya Tata Avritta Palapushpa Samit Kushan Ekadasavanangyata. Once this Brahmana Ajamil, following the order of his father, went to the forest to collect fruit, flowers, and two kinds of grass called Samit and Kushya. On the way home, he came upon a Shudra, a very lusty fourth-class man, who was shamelessly embracing and kissing a prostitute. The Shudra was smiling, singing, and enjoying as if this were proper behavior. Both the Shudra and the prostitute were drunk. The prostitute's eyes were rolling in intoxication, and her dress had become loose. Such was the condition in which Ajamil saw them. Purport. While traveling along the public way, Ajamil came upon a fourth-class man and a prostitute, who are vividly described here. Drunkenness was sometimes manifest even in bygone ages, although not very frequently. In this age of Kali, however, such sin is to be seen everywhere, for people all over the world have become shameless. Long ago, when he saw the scene of the drunken Shudra and prostitute, Ajamil, who was a perfect brahmachari, was affected. Nowadays, such sin is visible in so many places, and we must consider the position of a brahmachari student who sees such behavior. For such a brahmachari to remain steady is very difficult, unless he is extremely strong in following the regular principles. Nevertheless, if one takes to Krishna consciousness very seriously, he can withstand the provocation created by sin. In our Krishna consciousness movement, we prohibit illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling. In Kali Yuga, a drunk, half-naked woman embracing a drunk man is a very common sight, especially in the Western countries. And restraining oneself after seeing such things is very difficult. Nevertheless, if by the grace of Krishna, one adheres to the regular principles and chants the Hare Krishna mantra, Krishna will certainly protect him. Indeed, Krishna says that his devotee is never vanquished. Kaunteya pratijani name bhakta pranashyati. Therefore, all the disciples practicing Krishna consciousness should obediently follow the regular principles and remain fixed in chanting the holy name of the Lord. Then there need be no fear. Otherwise, one's position is very dangerous, especially in this Kali Yuga. Om Agyanatramanandasya Agyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. We are getting a very vivid description here from the Srimad Bhagavatam.
about a very unfortunate situation. Srimad Bhagavatam contains history, not necessarily in chronological order. The order of events presented in Srimad Bhagavatam is according to the sweet desires of Shukadeva Goswami, and according to the sweet desires of Prichit Maharaj, the questions he asks. The main thing is the lesson to be learned. Therefore, exemplary things are only contained in Srimad Bhagavatam. It is never stated that Srimad Bhagavatam contains the history of everything. No. Why do intelligent people want to be concerned with every silly thing that happens? That's what you have to go through when you study history now at your school or university. You have to learn every stupid thing. But Srimad Bhagavatam gives you history, but only historical events that will propel you back to Godhead, because that is the purpose of the cosmic manifestation. If you do not know the purpose of the cosmos, how are you going to learn any lessons? It's always fashionable for people to say that they're learning the lesson of life, they're evolving, they're maturing, they're growing. But what is the point that they're supposed to grow towards? What is the lesson they're supposed to learn? What are they supposed to be evolving toward? They have no idea. Actually, they do have an idea, although they can't articulate it. They think the standard is sense gratification. That's the lesson they want to learn. How to have sense gratification better and better. How to evolve towards better sense gratification. How to grow towards it. That's their hope. And their whole aspiration is how to have sense gratification and peace at the same time. We want individual peace and we want world peace. All amidst sense gratification uncontrolled everywhere. This is their great mission. No one understands anything about controlling the senses. We've been discussing in Melbourne. People think that you cannot be happy unless you have uncontrolled senses. They think that controlling the senses destroys pleasure. Now, from the Vedic standpoint, this means people are not human beings. They sunk deeply into animal life because they cannot understand the necessity to control the senses. So Srimad Bhagavatam contains events which will motivate you to go back to Godhead. Because that's the purpose of the cosmos. The purpose of having the human body in this material world is not to imitate the animals. The purpose is how to understand Krishna. So Srimad Bhagavatam is the perfect history for getting the job done of going back to Godhead. Unfortunately, mundane scholars always try to discourage people from taking the Srimad Bhagavatam seriously. They come up with an artificial analysis that there are some Vedic texts called the original Vedas, and these are the actual Vedic literature. Things like the Mahabharata, which contains Bhagavad Gita, and the Puranas, Srimad Bhagavatam, they all are later developments which were crafted by very poetic Hindu Brahmanas who wanted to try to unify all the different strands of religious belief. So they made the Srimad Bhagavatam, which has a bit of everything in it. This is their speculation. Therefore, if you really want to be Vedic, you should not read Srimad Bhagavatam. You should pretend you can understand the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, the Atharva Veda. Krishna is definitely there in those four Vedas. But in this age of Kali, it is impossible for anyone to see Krishna there without the help of a Vaishnava Acharya. It doesn't mean that Krishna only became popular when Srimad Bhagavatam propagated him in the first millennium of this AD. That's what these scholars will teach people at school, that the worshipping of
Vishnu, and even worship of Krishna especially, that's all a later development. The love god, the Hindu love god, came about only a few thousand years ago. And they say, it's obvious that that's the conclusion, because you won't find any mention of Krishna in the real Vedas, the original Vedas. They won't find, because they don't have the purity to see. The Vedic literature is state specific. According to your consciousness, that's what you'll understand from them. Brahmanaditi Brahmana. If you want to understand Brahman, the supreme absolute truth, you have to develop Brahminical qualities. No use waving your university diploma. No use telling all the courses you've taken. If you want to have real intellect for understanding transcendental knowledge, you have to develop Brahminical qualities of mind and sense control, simplicity, austerity, purity, cleanliness, tolerance, like that. Otherwise, you cannot understand. Why? You might get very upset. Why can't I understand? All I have to do is open the book and read it. If it needs to be translated, I'll find a translation of it. What's the problem? I've got eyes. The problem is that you do not control your perception. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, Matasmritya Gyanam Aponam Cha. I'm within your heart, and I let you understand what I want you to understand. This is at the root, the crux of the whole situation of knowledge. We are not in control of our knowledge-acquiring activities. Intelligence actually depends on the Lord in the heart. He decides what you can know, what you will remember, what you will forget. So Krishna consciousness focuses right on this crux. Let us please Krishna, and in that way become supremely intelligent. Supremely intelligent meaning we can fully revive all the awareness that a part and parcel of Krishna is meant to revive. We will never become omniscient, but by Krishna's arrangement, a devotee knows whatever Krishna wants him to know. That is omniscience for a part and parcel of Krishna. Whatever you need to know to serve Krishna, Krishna will let you know. Doesn't mean that because you're a great devotee, you should know the score of the rugby match in Scotland or something, because you're supposed to know everything. No. For a devotee, to be all-knowing means to know whatever he needs to know to serve Krishna. So Bhakti Yoga directly grapples with this point that your intelligence, what you can know and understand, is under someone else's control. This is very humiliating for Westerners to accept, because in the West, people are so fascinated with their own intelligence and speculative ability. They think they really have the ability to understand things. But when you come to Krishna consciousness, you learn that all perception and awareness is under the control of the super soul in the heart. That's why we can't see Krishna now. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, Naham Prakasha Sarvasya Yoga Maya Samavita. I'm not manifest to everyone. I don't let everyone see me. I keep them covered. If they don't have qualifications to see me, I keep them covered by my illusory potency. So we deal directly with this Krishna who is controlling our knowledge, our remembrance, our forgetfulness. What's an example of Krishna controlling your forgetfulness? If you're a non-devotee, if you desire to forget Krishna, then Krishna will help you do that. You cannot even forget Krishna without his help. This is how independentless you are. You want to forget Krishna? You need his help. You have the desire, and you finally convince Krishna, I want to forget you. I want to enjoy my senses. Reluctantly, Krishna says, all right, I'll arrange it so you never remember me, birth after birth. Mudha janmani janmani, birth after birth, you'll be a fool. Not just one birth, but birth after birth. For a devotee, Krishna is also controlling the forgetfulness. How does he do that? He helps a devotee to forget material desires. There is the secret. Sometimes you wonder, how will I ever get free of these material desires? What will become of me? Should I just give in? Avoid the rush? Give in now? Maybe if I give in now, by the time I'm an old lady or old man, then I'll be over it. I'll have, you know, burned myself out. Maybe you're supposed to give in when you're young or in your 20s and 30s. Get through it all. No, you never get through it all that way. Impossible. Just like you can never put out a fire by dropping kerosene on it. The fire just gets bigger and bigger and you get more and more burnt out. The way you get over material desires is by convincing Krishna to put out the fire for you. He gives you big hints. More than hints, he gives you instructions. In Srimad Bhagavatam you can read Shinvata Sakata Krishna Punya Shavana Kirtana Priyantasta Yubadlani Virunoti Sugatsita. When you hear about Krishna, the super soul in the heart cleanses the desire for material enjoyment. So that's how Krishna helps a devotee to forget material desires. It is not hopeless. There is all possibility of victory. Simply, through the 9 processes of devotional service, we have to convince Krishna what we really want. And that means sometimes you've got to beg. You've got to plead. The best way to beg and plead is through chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Don't chant mechanically. Chant from the heart, pleading Krishna, give me your devotional service. Free me from material desires. You can also pray to Krishna. Go before the deities and plead. Don't be too proud to beg. That's why we have the deities. We can fall on your face before them and cry out to Supreme Lord, please free me from these shackles. You have to convince Krishna. Just like when you want to get a job, you have to convince the employer that you have some value, that you'll do a good job. Similarly, when you want to become free from material desires, you have to convince Krishna that you're serious. And Maya is there to keep the insincere, not serious persons away from bugging Krishna. Just like, let's say, Shivananda, he's hiring. His business has quadrupled, so he needs more staff. So he doesn't want to put an ad in the newspaper and be besieged with like 1,000 people bothering him, all who have, you know, most of them who have no qualifications that he's looking for. No, he wishes that only the most sincere, qualified persons would apply, and then he can choose amongst them. So Maya does that job for Krishna. She keeps all the insincere ones away from Krishna. And she does a favor for the sincere devotees by providing them with situations in which they must increase their dependency on Krishna. So there is complete hope for us to conquer material desires. But we have to understand a basic point, the crux of the matter. We are not the ultimate controllers of our perception, of our forgetfulness, of our knowledge. Krishna, as super soul, is in control of that. Therefore, hopefully now we can understand why lifestyle has a complete relationship with what we can comprehend. It's another difficult point for Westerners to accept. They think there's a complete separation between how you behave and what you can understand. Therefore, they feel no hesitation to act like cats and dogs, and at the same time think they can give an intellectual pronouncement about any subject matter. Science, the creation, the universe, the Vedas, the Puranas, anything. By our method of critical scholarship. Researching. Making intelligent hunches, we can hold forth on anything. And you inferior people who simply adhere to these scriptures, you're just fodder for us to study. It's amusing. We know history. We've studied this for so long. There's always these faithful religious people with their scriptures and with their belief in something, something beyond. Actually, this is a necessary thing for most human beings. Not everybody is fortunate to be a critical scholar and become immune to these tendencies. Probably there was some purpose and in evolution. Yes, this religious fervor was probably an evolutionary adaptation. Somehow or other, it allowed the survival of the human species. But of course, now we can see it's becoming more and more unnecessary. Therefore, probably new human beings will evolve who don't have this religious spirit, because no longer is it necessary for survival. So these are the people who present the Vedic literatures to others. And they tell you the Puranas are not really essential. They're just later additions. Particularly the Srimad Bhagavatam, definitely very late. They want to make a complete split between the Bhagavatam and the Rig Veda, Tarva Veda, Sama Veda, Yajur Veda. That way it's very easy to get rid of Krishna. And that's the name of the game. That's why we're in this material world, to get rid of Krishna. Now, as long as people take Srimad Bhagavatam seriously, it's very difficult to get rid of Krishna. But if you just push the Bhagavatam to one side and then tell everybody, read the Vedas, read the Upanishads, read Vedanta Sutra. You're a Western man, woman, you've got full critical resources. Read them. Do you see Krishna on every page there? Not there. So why all this fuss about Krishna by these later sects that emphasize Krishna, Radha Krishna, the Hindu love god? If you're really interested in the Vedas, then you have nothing to do with Krishna. Actually, Krishna can be found everywhere in all the Vedic literatures. But in Kali Yuga, people don't have the brains to see that. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that in the age of Kali, if you try to just read the Upanishads or Vedanta Sutra, you'll become an atheist or an agnostic. Not because there's something wrong with those texts, but you don't have the ability to see Krishna in them. Just like when it comes to the Rig Veda. Oh, the Rig Veda's got so many hymns glorifying different demigods. Very few verses directly mentioning Vishnu. So what the scholars do is a bean count. Okay, let's say we've got 100 verses for Agni, 150 for Indra, so on and so forth. And we've got 5 for Vishnu. Oh, it's obvious what's going on. Completely obvious. Vishnu is not very important. Only later in the history of Hinduism did Vishnu assume crucial importance. And then this Krishna came about. And in order to tie the whole thing together, the tricky Hindu Brahmanas made a package of Vishnu and Krishna and said they're the same. So, this is what they teach people. In this way, they have very nicely isolated themselves from the literary incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. These sages at Naimisaranya, they're worried. Krishna has departed, accompanied by all religion. How are the people going to be protected? The age of Kali introduced itself right about the time of the end of Kali Yuga, but Krishna was still around for a while, so it did not manifest. Prichit Maharaj noticed Kali Yuga having its effect. He saw that irreligion had infiltrated his kingdom, So he decided to go on the warpath, not for economic conquest, not for imperialism. No, he decided to go on the warpath because he saw signs of degradation creeping into his empire. Now, there was no way that Kali Yuga could work its show as long as Pritchett Maharaj was around. Therefore, to fulfill the desires of those who want Kali Yuga, Krishna exited Pritchett Maharaj. Also, this gave a chance for Srimad Bhagavatam to be spoken. So we must understand, when we sometimes lament about the horrors of today, that we desired Kali Yuga. We wanted to be around at this time. Maybe not directly. We wanted to be around in that we wanted to experience all the devilish delights that Kali Yuga specializes in. Illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling. We had the desire to experience these things, and here we are. They're available not only individually, but the whole society is drowning in these things. So when you're a sinful person, you think, what could be better? There's nothing that could be better than this. Organized sinful activity. Everywhere I turn, there's illicit sex. Everywhere I turn, there's intoxication. Your family's absorbed in it. Your friends absorbed in it. Your school's absorbed in it. Your work's absorbed in it. Your politicians are absorbed in it. This is the greatest thing. That's the problem. Now, in today's verse, we're seeing that Ajamil saw something that was considered rare at that time. He saw a low-class man and woman embracing. Notice the description of their so-called happiness. It sounds, and if we witness such a scene today, in our impure mind, we think, oh, this is really great. When will that happen to me? Just listen to this. Now, just forget the word shamelessly. Just concentrate on the embracing and kissing. Oh, indeed. To see it in public and not have to pay to go to the movies? Wonderful. Smiling, singing, enjoying. As if this were proper behavior. Forget that part. There's no standards. The point is he's happy. Just remember that. What could be wrong with that? Right? Singing, dancing, singing, smiling. They were drunk. Well, it happens to the best of people, you know. I mean, they probably weren't that drunk. But, I mean, you know, they were having a good time. You know, drinking, you know, it does help making merry. It's not that you should be drunk every day, then you're an alcoholic. But certainly weekends are made for that. What's wrong? You've paid your dues, you've worked during the week. Are you successfully remained on the dole without working for another week? So what's wrong with drinking on the weekend? Not every day. We're not alcoholics. A little libido, a little lust, you know, that's what it's all about. So what's wrong with this? You know, why are you criticizing this person? The prostitute's eyes were rolling in intoxication, and her dress had become loose. No. She's been wearing a dress anyway. She's supposed to be scantily clad. Eyes rolling in intoxication? She's having a good time. And why are you calling her a prostitute? This is a value judgment. If you're trying to imply that, you know, she's a lady an experienced lady, what's wrong with that? You know, she knows how to be happy. And it's her choice that she does not want to chain herself within the confines of marriage. She's understanding that, you know, if pleasure is lust, then let it flow freely. And the man's understanding that too. In fact, they sound quite psychologically wholesome to me. And anyway, even if she really is one of those ladies who makes her money in a certain way, that's just her career. They're not called prostitutes these days. Anyway, they are called sex workers. They offer a desired commodity on the market. They are necessary. We shouldn't look down upon them. So this is the way people think today. There's no standard of proper behavior. There's no such thing as sin. The main thing is to have a good time without hurting others too badly. But you see, if everybody simply tries to enjoy, then even if there is a little bit of hurt and pain, it's minimized by the mass effort to enjoy. That's how it works, you see, haven't you noticed? All each person has to do, you should try to enjoy. And then somehow, even if there are some discrepancies, it becomes minimized in the mass thrust for enjoyment. It all works like that. That's what they tell you. So what do you have as the goal of Western civilization? Sense gratification and peace at the same time. Impossible. But Western civilization means let's make it possible. Let's have no morals, let's have no sense control, let's all become degraded and dance like cats and dogs, and there'll be world peace and individual contentment. Impossible. As soon as there is sense gratification, there must be distress. This we have to convince ourselves of. You cannot have one without the other. Our whole problem is we think we are the enjoyer. It takes quite a bit of cleansing to realize I am not the enjoyer. It is constitutionally impossible for me to be the enjoyer. We cannot really accept this or believe it. But what's the shortcut to understanding it? You don't have to torture yourselves and tie your hands behind your back, bite your tongue till you turn blue. No. All you have to do is hear about Krishna's enjoyment. And then your standard changes. When you hear about Krishna's activities, automatically you think, I can't do that. And in fact, I'm getting more pleasure by hearing Krishna's enjoying than my so-called attempts at enjoying. Then things start to get peaceful. Then your grip on the material energy slackens, the hard knot in the heart slackens, because you hear about Krishna, and because you're not offensive, you're not a Mayavadi, you realize, I cannot compete with Krishna. Let me just assist Krishna in his pleasure. You start to realize, just by me sitting on the floor and hearing about Krishna, I'm feeling more contented than anything I've ever done in my life. So then you start to get a desire to serve Krishna with all your senses. Hearing the service, but then you start to think about your whole life. Well, if I got such pleasure and peace just by hearing, what about if I engage all my senses in Krishna's service? And then you start to take the process of bhakti yoga very seriously. I want to be part of an organized situation in which my senses have the maximum chance to engage in the devotional service of the Lord. Krishna never has any problem with enjoying. He can do anything, any kind of way, and still be the supreme enjoyer, supreme personality of Godhead. Just like at the end of the Rajasuya description in the Krishna book, you'll read about the organization of the Rajasuya Yajna by Yudhishthira Maharaj after it happened, after Shishupal was killed. How did Krishna kill Shishupal? Without spreading one drop of blood at the sacrificial arena. Because if blood was shed, the whole sacrifice would be ruined. That's what Shishupal had as his goal. He was anti-Krishna. He hated Krishna. And he waited to what he thought was the most precise moment to disturb the yajna. Right there in that Rajasuya yajna, you have the clash between divine and demoniac. Yudhishthira wanted to stage this king of all yajnas, king of all sacrifices, to demonstrate that Krishna is the supreme. Yudhishthira presented his plan to Krishna. Krishna had come to Hastinapur. There was a bit of a contention, family contention. In Dwarka, at the Sudharma assembly house, Krishna and his clan were all there, Ugrasen, Krishna's sons, grandsons, they were all holding forth the royal court. And then a messenger from the imprisoned kings, Jarasandha had imprisoned so many kings, He came and made an appeal to Krishna. Please hear this, think about it, and act on it in a way you think is appropriate. So after hearing the appeal of that messenger, all the Yadus decided, all the Kshatriyas, they decided, yes, yes, great, let's go fight Jarasandha, liberate these kings, they're Krishna's devotees. Then, right at that time, Narada Muni shows up. He's got golden hair, extraordinary countenance. Immediately Krishna stands up, bows his head, makes sure Narada Muni has a seat. This is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, teaching how to respect the great devotee. So Krishna says to him, you travel throughout all the three planetary systems. You know what's going on. Please give us news of the universe. And particularly, please tell us the plans of the Yadus, particularly Yudhisthira. Excuse me, please tell us the plans of the Pandavas, particularly Yudhisthira. What are they going to do? So Narada Muni replies. He's understanding Krishna's supreme enjoyer. He knows Krishna is enjoying this way. Krishna knows everything, but he's telling me that I know everything. So he says, what is unknown to you? You say that I'm the cosmic traveler, the knower of the three planetary systems, but the whole universe is just your energy. It comes from you. Furthermore, you are the super soul in everyone's heart. You know what everyone's going to do. But since you're asking me, I will participate in this leela, and I will reply that Yudhisthira Maharaj wants to perform the topmost Vedic sacrifice, the Rajasuya Yajna, to glorify you. So I think you should immediately go to Hastinapur and participate in this great sacrifice so the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead will be established everywhere. Then what happened? The princes, the Yadu dynasty, didn't like this because they were ready to fight. They like, you know, they're Kshatriyas, they like battle, so they were all prepared to go fight Jarasandha to liberate the kings. Now here is Narada Muni diverting everything in another direction. So there was some family disagreement. So Krishna turned to Uddhava. He said, Uddhava, I want to see the situation through you. Your judgment is so appropriate, whatever you advise we'll do. What did Uddhava think? Oh, how great am I? Krishna is asking me to give advice. I'm the all-knowing. I actually must be Krishna. That's what the Lord is indicating, that we all are God. He's God. He's recognizing I'm God. Now, this is what someone in Kali Yuga would think. Uddhava knew. The Lord is simply giving me some service. He is all-knowing, yet He is asking my advice. So, Uddhava replied that there's no way the Rajasuya sacrifice can be performed unless all the kings in the world become subordinate to Yudhisthira. Therefore, although ordinarily we should immediately proceed to the sacrificial arena without haste, something has to be done about Jarasandha. Therefore, we have to deal with Jarasandha. So Krishna said, okay. Still, Krishna went to Hastinapur to see his devotees first, and then he went to deal with Jarasandha. So he got to Hastinapur. Yudhisthira gave him such an ecstatic reception. And Yudhisthira presented his whole program, why he wanted this sacrifice. He said, this sacrifice is to satisfy the demigods. They're all going to show up. But I'm doing it not to please them, actually, because we're your devotees, Krishna. What do we need to please the demigods for? But I'm making this sacrifice and having them all come so that they will see that you are the supreme. I want to establish you, Krishna, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead without a doubt, in front of all the demigods, in front of Shiva, Brahma, everyone. Furthermore, I want to show the difference. I want to show the world the difference between accepting you as an ordinary person and accepting you as a Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is why Indologists, they don't like Srimad Bhagavatam. Everything is there point blank. Srila Prabhupada said, that's why Shankaracharya, he did not touch Srimad Bhagavatam. There's Krishna there so easily. That doesn't mean it's a lower text. It means that Vyasadeva wrote his own commentary on his Vedanta Sutra so that we could see that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It doesn't mean that Krishna wasn't in the other literatures, but without sufficient intelligence you won't see it. But in Srimad Bhagavatam, it's there so openly. Therefore, the best way to understand the Vedas is to read the author of the Vedas' commentary. Bhashyam Brahma Sutranam. Read the commentary on the Brahma Sutra, the Vedanta Sutra. That is Srimad Bhagavatam. So, our acharyas teach us how to see everything interrelated. And it's not just some kind of religious concoction. Well, if they're going to push on their religion, they've got to do something with the so-called original Vedas and the later Vedic texts and stitch them all together. Now, by hearing from a Vaishnava Acharya, you can see the whole symphony working together. And it's so powerfully inspiring. Srila Prabhupada does it in his purports. You see how all the Vedic literatures are meant to bring about knowledge of Krishna. So Yudhisthira, as emperor of the world, he felt the responsibility how everyone can understand that Krishna is supreme. So he thought, I want to show a way that they can see the difference in accepting Krishna as an ordinary person and as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I want to show the difference between devotees of Krishna and worshippers of the demigods. That's my purpose for doing the Rajasri Yajna. So Krishna told him, very good, this is approved by all the senior personalities of the universe. Your fame will be eternal for doing this. So, first there had to be some conditions met, sufficient resources had to be gathered, Jarasandha had to be subdued. So, at the sacrifice, when it was finally happening, the moment of the Agra Puja came to select the most worshipable person. There seemed to be a little lack of agreement, or it's not that everyone immediately said, Krishna, Krishna. Even Brahma and Shiva were there. They didn't say anything right away. The acharyas say that they were waiting to see what would happen, and if things got too out of hand, no one said Krishna, then they would say something. So then, who is it, Sahadev? There can be no greater person than Krishna. So everyone agreed, Jai, he has spoken very wonderfully. There can be no more worshipable person than Krishna. So they all proceeded to do the Agra Puja for Krishna. Such a transcendently powerful moment. Did Shishupal stop the whole thing there? No. He controlled his senses for his demoniac purposes and waited till the most critical moment of the sacrifice. And then he threw his rage. There are so many worshipable persons here. You could have chosen any one of them. They are great tapasvis, great mystic yogis, great realizers of Brahman, great sadhus. You could have picked any one of them, but you pick Krishna. We don't even know what Varna he's from. What is he, a Brahmana, Kshatriya, a Vaishya? Sometimes he's acting like a cowherd boy, sometimes he's acting like a prince. What is he? We don't know. Look at his modus operandi. He's hid himself in a fort in the ocean, and every once in a while he comes out from the fort and harasses the persons like a marauder. This is who you've chosen, this Krishna. So, obviously, because there are devotees present there, this was completely intolerable. Some of them left. That's the Vedic injunction that if you can't do something about it, you have to leave. Others were tugging at their swords, ready to do something. So, this was a critical moment, because if there was bloodshed, if there was a fight, the whole yajna would be ruined, and so much endeavor had been made to put on this yajna. It was a worldwide event. It took the resources of the whole world. And it's about to be ruined. That's Shishupal's hope. But Krishna is more intelligent. With his Sudarshan chakra disc, he cut off Shishupal's head without shedding a drop of blood. So then the sacrifice went on. Afterwards, we can read in Krishna book the organization of the sacrifice, how Yudhisthira had put different Pandavas in charge of different departments. Even Duryodhana had a department, the treasury. Bhima was in charge of the kitchen. Bhima, the voracious eater, he's in charge of the kitchen. Krishna had a department too. The supreme personality of Godhead, his department was washing the feet of the guests. This is Krishna. He enjoys any kind of way. How about Krishna waking up in Dwarka? Who can wake up like this? Try it. First, the aroma of the Parijata flowers floats through the air. The bees pick up the aroma and start buzzing. Then the buzzing of the bees wakes up the birds. They start chirping. Then Krishna arises. But his queens don't like that. They curse the birds because they're there with Krishna embracing him. But Krishna is not slowed down in the least by the comfortable embraces of his wives. He rises. He washes his mouth, hands, and feet, and he meditates on himself. Now, can he do any of this? Do you have 16,108 wives? But when the birds start chirping in the Brahma Muhurta hour, you get up without a moment's hesitation? Maybe difficult with one, I don't know. But 16,108? Impossible. Krishna has no material contamination about him. There's no question of sleeping in the mode of ignorance. There's no question of mode of passion. Everything is perfectly spiritual. So Krishna gets up. He meditates on himself because he is the supreme. He contains Brahman, the glow of his body. From him, the Paramatma expands the Supersoul in the heart. So when we hear about Krishna, we forget about trying to enjoy, which is impossible. Otherwise, Prabhupada emphasizes in this chapter, again and again, it's very difficult to withstand this kind of provocation. Very difficult. He says it in about four purports. Very difficult. So, we might think it's hopeless. But at the same time, Srila Prabhupada emphasizes that strong engagement in devotional service, strong chanting of the holy name will protect you. It will get the job done. So there we have it. Two things at once. Very difficult to withstand this thing. And the power of the holy name and the power of devotional service. So we have to choose our stand. We have to make our position. Now, what was unusual during Ajamil's time is very common now. That is a great problem. Just think about Ajamil's qualifications. He was an ideal Brahminical student. Reservoir of good character. Studied all the Vedic literatures. Good conduct and good qualities. Firmly established in executing all the Vedic injunctions. He was very mild and gentle. And he kept his mind and senses under control. Furthermore, he was always truthful. He knew how to chant the Vedic mantras, and he was also very pure. Ajamil was very respectful to his spiritual master, the fire god, guests, and the elderly members of his household. He was free from false prestige. He was upright, benevolent to all living entities, well-behaved. He would never speak nonsense or envy anyone. Wow, this guy must be a pure devotee or something. Actually, Srila Prabhupada points out that Ajamil was very nicely situated in the mode of goodness, but he was not fixed on the Vaishnava platform. He was not absorbed in devotional service. Therefore, he had some difficulty dealing with this provocation. So that is one lesson we can learn. that how do we expect to conquer material nature in that we are free from being provoked into horrible activities? How can we do that without strong absorption in devotional service? Who are we trying to kid? Another angle that Srila Prabhupada gives about Ajamil, he was speaking very gently once in Philadelphia. Devotee asked Prabhupada about accidental fall down. And Prabhupada explained, Ajamil is one such example. That he was held up at gunpoint by material nature. In other words, material nature with a gun just said, you're finished. He didn't plan it, but he was held up and dragged down. So a devotee asked Srila Prabhupada, well, how do we know what's an accidental fall down? Srila Prabhupada said very gently, only I can tell. In other words, the possibility is there, but it's not that we should very cheaply analyze everything in that way. There's no need that we have to experience the poisons of material nature. And we have to convince ourselves that we are not the enjoyer. And ordinarily, if we read such a description as this, on the way home he came upon a Sudra, a very lusty fourth-class man who was shamelessly embracing and kissing a prostitute. The Sudra was smiling, singing, and enjoying as if this were proper behavior. Both the Sudra and the prostitute were drunk. The prostitute's eyes were rolling in intoxication. Her dress had become loose. Such was the condition in which Ajamil saw them. In describing this, Prabhupada just sums it all up. What Ajamil saw was they were practically doing everything for sex life right in public. So these are all the things that Maya is trying to catch us with. Just making merry. Just finally relaxing and just letting yourself be, just letting the passions flow in a reciprocal way. This is what Western civilization is pushing us towards. And if you need a little intoxication to lighten things up, what's wrong? Just don't become addicted. If you can help somebody else out in this way, and they can help you out in this way, isn't that enough? What more do you want out of life? This vision is inspired by thinking we are the enjoyer. It comes from passion and ignorance. Some or other we have to convince ourselves. Uncontrolled senses do not lead to happiness. When you start thinking like that, you're going against everything in this society and culture. And this is what sometimes troubles our endeavors to become Krishna conscious. We have not gotten it into our heads that uncontrolled senses do not equal happiness. So we have to be trained up. We have to take a proper position and engage ourselves in devotional service in such a way that we are sufficiently protected against the onslaughts of Maya. The more vibrantly you engage in devotional service, the more you realize Krishna is the enjoyer. And that diminishes your own appetite to be the enjoyer. Simply by hearing about Krishna, that's done. We should never underestimate the potency of just hearing about Krishna. And then, when you speak what you remember, that is smarnam. Besides kirtan, it's also smarnam because you're analyzing, you're remembering. You're going over. What is it in this purport? What is it that Prabhupada is saying? How is it that I think I'm the enjoyer when actually everything is ruining my enjoyment? When you start analyzing like that, that is smarnam. Third process of devotional service. And this becomes thicker and thicker and thicker. Then your Krishna conscious intelligence starts to develop. When you start analyzing everything through your Krishna conscious smarnam, to your remembrance of what you've heard and chanted. You start seeing things in that way. Then life becomes fun. And it can happen. It does happen. Krishna told Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, Bahovo Jnana Tapasa, many, many persons have become purified by knowledge of me. They've done it. You can do it too, Arjuna. Okay, it's Kali Yuga. We don't have the qualifications of Arjuna and the Pandavas. But we have the holy name. The holy name acts in all millenniums, all yugas, but it's especially effective by Krishna's arrangement in the age of Kali. Therefore, great saints and sages worship Kali Yuga. Why? Because of all the stuff mentioned in the verse? No. Because you can easily go back to Godhead in Kali Yuga just by chanting Hare Krishna. So let us understand what we are battling against. Our wonderful Western upbringing has convinced us that pleasure means uncontrolled senses. When in doubt, just do it. And real human civilization begins with controlling the senses. It doesn't even make you a transcendentalist. It just makes you a human being. So this is the problem that Krishna consciousness is struggling with. How to make people human beings, get them to understand that happiness doesn't mean uncontrolled senses. And to solidify the victory, you must accept Krishna as the enjoyer. Otherwise, you leave yourself in a risky position. You may be doing everything very motive goodnessy, but without transcendental devotional service to the Lord, the realization that Krishna is the enjoyer never completely develops. Therefore, you leave yourself wide open. Ajamil, he's following the order of his father. He's going to the forest for what? To space out? No, he's going to the forest to collect ingredients for the sacrifice. Everything seems to be happening right. But he saw this scene, and that ruined his spiritual life. He took the prostitute into his home. He even neglected his own Brahmana wife. Many decades he passed life in this way, committing many crimes in order to get income, having children when he's an old man. All these things are considered atrocious from the Vedic standpoint. Not considered atrocious today. Ajamil, he was in his 80s, he had a baby. Everyone would say, great! What was he using, Viagra or something? Wow, a potent guy. This character who ran for president in the USA a few years ago, Dole, old man, running for president in his late 70s or something. Just last month, he testified to the whole nation. It's an old man, 77, 78 years old. Basically, he said, praise the Lord for Viagra. It's made such a change in my life. He's supposed to be a conservative guy. So people think if they can have lusty affairs into their 70s, that society has advanced so much. Vedic culture means definitely by the time you're 50, all that kind of activity stops. So everything we're doing is different. We're going another direction. And that requires momentum. So the more we come to grips with how to get the momentum we need to go in another direction, then our Krishna consciousness becomes very serious. Any questions? Guruji and Prabhu, any favor us with some comment? That's how Prabhupada explained it. And what do you mean by that? What is accurate history? So you're saying accurate history means things are in chronological order. But that is one conception of history. The Purana conception of history is that things are, the incidents mentioned are producing a desired effect. So for the case of the Amala Purana, the spotless Purana, the desired effect is love of Krishna. Otherwise, simply to repeat the incidents done by every fool and rascal, what does that do for you? But I know, if you're a Western scholar, you really make a fetish about it. It's all in perfect order. We've got, you know, this happened and that happened and this happened. What's the point of it all being in perfect order when it's all useless for the sake of a human or benefit of a living entity? And anyway, they can't even understand that they can't see material nature properly. They're not seeing the events, even mundane events, they don't see properly. They don't understand how they're blinded by that.